My name is Evan Roth. Graffiti was something I was only passively interested in until I moved from Los Angeles to New York and kind of gave up my car and then became a pedestrian, and I was walking to school a lot, being close enough to the walls that I could study it and started taking photos. That was how I got into graffiti. Before I had come into IBM, I did a project while I was in graduate school at Parsons called Graffiti Analysis, which dealt with graffiti as a data source. It was meeting with graffiti writers, capturing their tag using a computer vision system, and then projecting it back up around the city. And it wasn't until the media kind of came knocking and asking for interviews that IBM I think got embarrassed that we were the two fellows hanging out in the trash chute 10 hours a day. That's the best thing that came out of that New York Times article, was we didn't have to hang out in the garbage chute anymore.
Yeah, but it was...
We knew that we wanted to use our time with our fellowship to research graffiti, to make tools for that community. But we were thinking about graffiti maybe in a slightly different way. And we'd been using that word to mean anything that happens outside in the city without permission. When we were thinking about what's graffiti's relationship with technology, we were also thinking this doesn't necessarily mean high technology. I mean, we've come to think of the spray can as probably the best technology that's ever happened to graffiti. But we were interested in thinking of technology also in the sense of like the hacker mentality and how hackers treat software as sort of the same way that graffiti writers and street artists treat the city. They look for these systems, they identify them, and then they flip them a little bit to tell something that the city didn't intend to tell. This is a Leon Reed image where he added one security camera so that it not only makes the other security camera non-functional, but sort of makes a statement on surveillance. Mark Jenkins has some of these other ones where he's tied into different systems. This is an example where he sort of hacked the system of telephone booths. One of our heroes here, Sir Banks-a-Lot, he went around to museums both in London and in New York and installed his own artwork within the gallery settings. So this is him putting up some of his work in the Brooklyn Museum. For me, seeing some of Banksy's images early on when I was still considering myself an architect kind of changed the whole course of my career. So without the web, me coming across work like that would have never happened. And to this day, I've only seen a few, you know, Banksy pieces in person. When people are like, oh, graffiti doesn't happen in magazines, it doesn't happen on the web, it happens in the street, I completely understand that mentality. People like Leon Reed and Mark Jenkins, I don't live in the UK, I don't live in DC, so I wouldn't have stumbled across a lot of these pieces that have really been influential, not just like individual pieces, but the whole sort of idea. And I think if you argue that graffiti is about affecting mind space, like how much are you up in the minds of the public, to ignore the internet would be to ignore like a huge audience. And so that's why this contagious media or viral media is a big part of what we do. And the reason why, you know, we view the counts on our YouTube clips as being something that's, you know, interesting and not just fame seeking, or maybe it's fame seeking and interesting, but either way.
much of a middle ground.
I think part of our interest in technology, too, is in technology that empowers people. And sometimes the coolest, highest tech thing, like a graffiti writing robot, maybe something that's like a better story for the media, but it's not necessarily better as a means towards an end in communicating in the city. And so that's why, like, we keep coming back to spray paint as this technology that is extremely empowering. Things like throwies and laser tag, even though they have some high-tech elements that maybe the media might latch onto as sort of a gizmo type thing, people can actually do this, and they can actually communicate on a scale that's larger than what they would have before. And so from all that, we formed our GRL mission statement that we are dedicated to outfitting graffiti writers, pranksters, artists, and protesters with open source tools for urban communication. So this is the drip sessions, which was more research that was based on how to capture the motion of graffiti. The drip sessions, graffiti analysis, laser tag, part of what I think is interesting about it is that you get to actually see the movement that's behind graffiti and how the fact that these tags are designed to be made quickly in public spaces can influence the way they look visually. We came up with a capture system that, unlike graffiti analysis, which just captured a series of XY coordinates, this actually captured all the pixels in video. And it was a really analog system. It was basically just a piece of glass that writers would write on, and it was backlit with a series of 500 and 1,000 watt light bulbs. Another digital projection project we did that take a sort of different approach was this series of studies called interactive or generative architecture. This one was done by British ninja Theodore Watson. This was a custom piece of software that Theo wrote using Open Frameworks, which is an open source C++ library. This is a hotel that's near where we are at iBeam, called the Maritime Hotel. And the software he wrote was a generative particle system that would draw lines based on whose lights were turned on and whose lights were turned off. If the light was on, it would spawn lines and particles, and it would try to connect circles where the light was on and would try to avoid circles that were off. This is an example of a digital system, you know, public space project, whether you want to call it graffiti or not, that's directly influenced from how graffiti writers treat the city. The graffiti writers that I'm most inspired by are the ones that don't just treat the city as a blank canvas where they can slap up whatever they want, but are writers that are really smart and intentional with how their tag fits into the city. So this is something that came from that influence. I think that's almost like an underlying current to a lot of the work we do, which is almost using technology in some cases like a trick, because people are easily seduced by technology. They're easily seduced by things that light. Throwaways are like practically a drug. And so you get those in the hands of people, and all of a sudden, before they know it, they've done their first sort of public space project. It's like a graffiti gateway drug. The very first throw, we just went outside and threw it up on the High Line, which is a giant metal structure that runs throughout the west side of Manhattan. It kind of worked just like we thought. You could get it up high enough to the point where it'd be really annoying to have to remove. We just decided that we could make these up with friends and students and go out, and if we threw up a bunch of them, maybe it'd be more interesting than if we threw up one. And so we went down to 23rd Street, which is just a couple blocks away. There happened to be a gallery here that has a giant steel wall that wraps around the entire outside of the building. We all walked down there with pockets glowing and threw them up. Probably after about 2 minutes, people that were on the sidewalk started to just get involved and take them down and throw them back up. That was the first time that we understood that there was something about throwaways that was more interesting than just making a building look like a Christmas tree. It had this social factor where people would just see this light and they'd want to get involved. And then you have all of a sudden the 10 people you came with turns into 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 people. You've got people out in the city having fun, making probably what might be their first public space project. So we came back and we had footage from that first night from probably about 3 or 4 video cameras. We edited up a quick video. I think I stole the music from that Sony Bravia advertisement sort of as a joke, in fitting with the sort of ethos of the lab. We released a how-to with it, which, like James said, is sort of a ridiculous how-to, but nonetheless, it was like a 7-page manual on how to wrap tape around a bunch of shit. What ended up happening, though, is that instead of people going crazy on the video, people went nuts on the how-to. That was, for me, definitely eye-opening in the sense that opening up your work and giving access to your work to people to make it their own and introducing it to the DIY community instead of just having it be, this is my art project, hands off. It makes your work more accessible. It makes your work more interesting in a sense. And in the end, it gets you more hits, which is all we're really interested in the end anyway. we were looking on Flickr and on YouTube for the tag throwaways, and we would find all these images of people making them and taking photos and putting them up online. Drinking beer. And it became this project that didn't exist just on our server, and it wasn't a project that just we updated. And I remember that feeling like one of the first moments where we were really facilitating what we set out to do, more so than when we were just throwing the throwaways and making videos. When Mark collaborated with us on the Jesus 2.0 project, it really felt like we had actually made something that a practicing street artist that we were really influenced and had a lot of respect for used something that we'd done to make work that was his own.
Yeah, and
you can imagine how excited they probably were for a sort of pop project that encouraged buying their product and then throwing them away and needing to buy more.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense why they got the throwaway pack page up on their website so quick, right? That's a way for me where, depending on what you're writing, if it's something you really mean, it's easier for me to swallow the environmental impact if what you said contributes to the world being a better place. And I think we originally thought we would never get into the sort of content business, but then, you know, you need to make Super Mario Brothers to sell Nintendo. You know, you need that sort of thing that lets people understand that there's something interesting that could happen here potentially. I think it still says Long Live Graffiti right off Broadway. Season's greetings from MTV. It was what advertisements always do when they see something cool that they don't have, which is how do they insert their brand into your creative project that they think is going to make MTV look all the cooler. And all the kids looked younger and more revolutionary than us. Even just the Christmas trees with the Coca-Cola logo replaced for the Christ star at the top, I always thought was a nice visual image. Wish we could have been there. They should have sent us an invite. Never forget. I teach a class called Geek Graffiti, which is a graduate level course that deals with introducing art and design oriented students to doing work outside. And so one of the former students from that, his name's Todd Vanderlinden, and I think we can call him out. He'll be happy about it probably, right? Former student was in Boston drunk one night, looks up above this bridge and sees what he would probably have thought to be LED throwies. He takes down this thing from the bridge. This is weeks before anybody ever heard of the Moon Knights, the Boston Paramount Tread. He takes photos of it, puts it on Flickr, and the Make blog reports on it. Yeah. No mention of terror, no mention of any sort of threat. They were only reporting on it as, look at, here's some circuit boards that we can look at.
I stole.
Right. And then he tagged it with Graffiti Research Lab, which is how we got wrapped into this whole thing. Which I think he did on purpose. I don't think he thought we did that. He's also been nice enough to, whether he knows it or not, put on permanent loan his original Moonanite that is now in the possession of the Graffiti Research Lab and travels with us wherever we go. It's our nightlight.
YouTube clip was interesting because it was also done kind of in our style. It was pretty good. It was fun to watch.
It shouts us out at the end also.
Yeah,
Yeah, I had sort of just gotten in the practice of when I see a YouTube clip, I like just put it on my hard drives because they tend to disappear. And that ended up being a good move because it ended up being one of the most popular YouTube clips I ever re-uploaded. Your attitude at the time, I remember, was it's never wrong to rat out a guerrilla advertiser.
Yeah.
And I think your attitude on that has now changed. I don't know if this is the end of the Throwies story or if it'll continue from here, but as an example of what happens when you release your work the way that we do, which is just directly into the public domain, free for all to take, it's fun to be able to watch this thing you sort of released turn into a major catastrophe. We went through the whole Moon and Night scare with the CEO of the anti-advertising agency, Steve Lambert. He's a new fellow to iBeam sitting right next door. The Light Criticism Project was really all Steve's initiative, as far as I remember. We were just there to help put the duct tape up. Light Criticism was a total rip on Geely. And we talked about that beforehand because we thought that there was some real potential power in taking this advertising infrastructure that they've installed around the subway stations in New York City and using that in typical hack fashion to twist what it's saying. He sort of took the first step by making this really sort of abstract art, single line of pixels. And the only thing more interesting than abstract art is like anything with content. Steve believes that ambiguous art is bad art. He just cut several of these stencils on our laser cutter, all geared towards the basic idea that advertising is the real problem and not graffiti. I think people really latched onto this one because people are generally pissed off in New York about the introduction of these television sets to the subway stations.
try to get up.
And it feels good when you beat the advertisers. And this was a case where it just kind of fell into our lap. We were working one night late in the lab. James comes running down, giddy as hell, grabs me, all excited because Perrier is projecting Perrier champagne ads right above our building. We have the equipment to fight back, sitting right underneath our desks. We grab the projectors, we get a long extension cable, we head up to our roof, and we just start projecting over top of their projections. Steve was up there using the laser. I think he drew balls. But in true Steve Lambert style, I think we needed to get more directly to the point of why we were pissed they were there. So instead of using the laser tag, we just opened up a text editor and just started basically talking trash for about 15 minutes. I think we were threatening to call 311 on them,
get off our wall,
trying to use as many swear words as possible. We knew that their advertisements were no longer serving the purpose of putting their product in a favorable position to the public, when we could hear people out on the street laughing after every sentence that we put up, railing against what they were doing. And then eventually they shut down. So it was a situation where we won. I mean, hands down, there was no debate in that one. It was after that that I was definitely amped up for the Summer of Blood, and this was more than a one-time thing we needed to do. He's generally just been a positive creative force to have around, whether we're dealing with writing-based tools or not. He's kind of come up with his own ideas that range from using microwaves to, like, remote-control UFO aircrafts.
Human feces.
And prosthetic limbs.
Yeah.
The main difference being with our version that there's a roller ball on the tip, so the weight of the whole device rests somewhat on the wall and somewhat in the hands of the rider, which is another reason we like Katsu, is because he has the strength of 10 men and can wield the unruly high rider like no other. The other sort of collaboration we've done with Katsu is the extinguisher stuff, the extinguisher POV cam, fire extinguisher riding. So this is not something we came up with at all, and this is something that Katsu's taught us how to do. But our influence on this is in spreading the how-to. A lot of these techniques that graffiti writers come up with that are incredible ways for individual people to get over on the city end up residing in cryptic graffiti forums, if that. And a lot of times graffiti writers are even pretty secretive about their craft so that they can have the tricks. But Katsu, fitting in with GRL release methods, has been kind enough to write a how to make your own fire extinguisher implement for graffiti. Our addition was only the documentation tool, which is the POV cam, which is basically a small disposable video camera duct taped with a wide angle lens and strapped to a welder's mask. I've been with people on the street where we've run into a giant Katsu extinguisher tag and they just didn't get it. They were like, it's ugly. I don't understand why that's interesting. And I was like, you know, think about how you would make that. How would you go about making a three-story tag like that in the middle of the Lower East Side? I think the helmet cam comes into play a little bit there too. So even though what we came up with was only a documentation tool and a little bit of influence in releasing a sort of how-to kit for the extinguisher, if you see that video and you see how someone can write their name in about 7 or 8 seconds, the size of a giant billboard, you start to understand how much power can reside in something as simple as a fire extinguisher. So laser tag, I think, is where we're ending the complete first season. This was sort of the climax of season one. Laser tag started with an email into the megaohmresistor@hotmail.com email account from a man named Hybe. software-wise, there's a lot of similarities between Graffiti Analysis and Laser Tag. I wasn't thinking about Graffiti Analysis at all for some reason. The main difference from Graffiti Analysis and some of the other stuff is with the Laser Tag, you're looking at what you're writing on, whereas with some of the other stuff we'd done, there was always some sort of capture system. It might be being projected on a big building, but it was drawn in a studio, or it's being captured on a little light box. There's something about not having your interaction mediated by a computer, or at least not one that you feel. The other thing that we found out was that although the Netherlands is a really tolerant place, one thing they're not tolerant of is lasers.
Yeah, after we...
But apparently no one's mentioned it to the police there either, because you'll see in the video that they pick it up and write Martin Rocks on the wall and never realized what they were doing.
Yeah.
When it got down to the wire, one of our bigger problems didn't have anything to do with programming or laser-related technology issue. It was just, how do we get these giant projectors on an airplane and to Rotterdam in one day? Like, that was one of the biggest technical hurdles we had in the whole thing. I remember there being sort of an interesting dichotomy between us being out in the cold in the parking lot with a bunch of graffiti writers and this kind of fancy Art Basel style art market, little bit bougie art for sale at high prices event going on inside. And the two did not overlap much except for when we went inside to get free whiskey.
I'm sure people.
We came back from that trip with 2 5,000 lumen projectors, a new laptop, a camera input system, a whole bag full of lasers. And that equipment ended up turning into what we call the mobile broadcast unit, a system that we can then check out to other people to use. By doing some of these events, it funds more in the future, and it allows us to sort of stockpile our weapons.
We got to do...
It is the kind of thing where you can really easily just hand someone the small laser and they can all of a sudden have their content up really big. But that requires us to sort of be out in the field and running the system. And it isn't necessarily the most flexible system for people that want to get other content up besides handwriting. And so really in the end, LaserTag is just one application that we've developed that runs from this mobile broadcast unit, which is a three-wheel bike equipped with multiple power sources, audio, 5,000 lumen projector, camera input, and a laptop. the mobile broadcast unit is a system that we can give over to other people so that they can have a larger presence in the city that they wouldn't have been able to afford otherwise. And we kind of joke that there's like a GRL library card. You can come check out this system, project your content for a night, and then it comes back to us when you're done. A28, which is the Dennis Kucinich supported impeachment of Dick Cheney, where everybody went out and basically wrote impeach in various sizes across the country. They contacted us, so we went out with them. We're happier when activist groups contact us than advertisers, obviously, but like James was saying, we're pretty much open to whoever will contact us. There's like a group of particularly vigilant soccer fans in Manchester. Through being soccer fans, got into being graffiti artists, so they were like stenciling the name of their soccer team, and then through that they got into like more general activist-y type things. They were reassuring me on the phone that it was not just to spell the name of their soccer team, that now that they are indeed like a political force to be reckoned with. Another thing that's going to happen in season two is that we're leveraging some of the interest we've been getting in the laser tag system to develop mobile broadcast units in other cities. So now when we get invitations to go somewhere, instead of just shipping out our equipment, we try to talk them into taking those costs we would have had associated with shipping our whole system over there into just buying a system that'll stay in whatever city we're going to. So we're setting up one of these in Mexico City. So now when we leave these cities, instead of just leaving people with a general impression of what loud Americans we are, they now have this thing that can stay behind and hopefully be used for the power of good against the power of evil.